Yes, so coming back to our study in Amos, I'd like to do a little bit of a review, as I normally do, so that any of you who have missed any of the previous studies will just be able to catch up a little bit. And while I'm trying to get everything organised here, I think we might have it. All right, so in tonight's study, you may have picked it up in the reading, you may not have. But there is an emphasis on the phrase, "Yet have ye not returned unto me." You see it in verse 6. "And I also have given you cleanness of teeth in all your cities and want of bread in all your places. Yet have ye not returned unto me, saith the Lord." You get it in verse 8, "Yet have ye not returned unto me, saith the Lord." You get it in verse 9, "Yet have ye not returned unto me, saith the Lord." You get it in verse 10, "Yet have ye not returned unto me, saith the Lord." You get it in verse 11, "Yet have ye not returned unto me, saith the Lord." Now, when it happens that often, we can obviously come to the conclusion that there is a very strong message. And the strong message that Amos, or that God is giving to Israel through Amos, is that despite everything, they haven't taken the right direction, they have not returned unto their God. And so the end result of this is going to be what we have on the screen before us: prepare to meet thy God. And this is where Israel is placed in the fourth chapter of our study tonight. God is telling them very clearly that the time is coming when judgment will come upon them and they will face the consequences. And the consequences are a direct result of spiritual poverty. And we'll see this as we look at the verses, starting with verse 1, and we will go through the chapter in perhaps a bit more detail than what we have up until now in the studies on the chapters. But here we come to where Amos is getting into what we would call the nitty-gritty of his message. And we'll see where this takes us. But just to quickly go through where we're at, where we've come to so far, the time period is around about the year 750 when Amos gives his message, and in the time of Uzziah, and the time of Jeroboam the second. Uzziah being the king in Judah, Jeroboam the second being king in Israel, or the northern kingdom. And we discussed Jeroboam the second, and he took after his namesake Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. And Jeroboam the first, he corrupted Israel, as you remember, by instituting idolatry in Bethel and in Dan, into the south and into the north, to prevent the people going, his people, as he considered them, the northern tribes or the northern kingdom, going into Jerusalem and being influenced by the worship at Jerusalem and staying in the south, not what he wanted. And so we've looked at chapters 2 and chapters 3 and we've moved on. We saw that Israel was ungrateful for the mercies of God. And in this expression by Barnes and his notes on the Bible, we quoted, "By a sort of economy in the toil of sinning, they blended many sins in one: idolatry, sensuality, cruelty, and in all the express breach of God's commandments." We spoke about the earthquake, which was quite famous. It's mentioned in Zechariah. We won't go into that right now. But as we look at the book, we see that essentially Amos is a call for justice and a warning for judgment. It was a warning for judgment because Israel, as we mentioned, I think, in the first study, had prospered under Jeroboam II. Jeroboam II was one of the greatest kings in terms of making Israel to prosper. That is after the time of Solomon. And so Israel in the north prospered under Jeroboam II. And so they gained a lot of material wealth. And this was mainly due to the fact that Israel enjoyed a period of peace, a long period of peace. And so they were able to spend all their resources on themselves. And so they gained in material prosperity, and guess where God went? God went completely out of their lives. They had no time for God. Their time was consumed in their own interests. And so while they maintained a form of worship and a form of religion, there was no real faith involved. It was an empty going through the motions. And so we saw that while this was all taking place and while Israel was developing their material wealth, because Assyria had been weak, now Assyria was becoming strong. And Assyria was gaining force, and Assyria on the horizon was ready to come in and bring her judgments upon that people. And of course, this was all according to God's plan. And so God is warning the people through his prophet. This is what's coming. You better look out. And you better start paying attention. Well, we know what happened. Of course, the prophet gave his message, and exactly what he said would happen did happen, because there was no change by the people. And so we see in the chapters 7 through 9 particularly, look ahead and see the end coming. It's on the horizon. Amos, his burden. And we saw the parallels between the prophet Amos and Christ. And remember what Amos said about his position. He was a nobody. And that's what they said about Jesus. What good thing can come out of Nazareth? And so it was with Amos. He was just a herdman, a keeper of the cattle and the sheep. He attended the fig trees. He eked out a living, no doubt, by his own two hands. And we saw we won't go through the chart obviously, but we saw as we looked at the comparisons between Amos and Christ that there were some real similarities. And his message would be a burden to all. And that's typically how it is with a prophet. And we know that being a prophet was not an easy thing to be. We pointed out on the map where Amos came from, Tekoa there in the south, and you'll see on the map there Beth-El, the town of Beth-El, and giving a little bit of an idea of the geography where Amos focused a lot of his attention, Amos was a man of godly wisdom. And in the early part of the prophecy, we saw the judgment upon the surrounding nations. The surrounding nations of Israel, Syria, the Philistines, the Tyre, or the Phoenicians, Edom, Ammon, Moab, and Judah. And God would bring his judgments, and he left them to the last, Israel and Judah, that they would be focused upon those two nations. We spent some time with this chart last time, so we won't do that again this time, and pointing out the transgressions of these different nations and why God was going to bring his judgments upon them. And just a little bit of a summary there, Amos 3, 3 through 8. And now we come to chapter 4, which is where we are tonight, and this is where we speak about the specific sins being denounced, the sins of luxury, hypocrisy, and obstinacy. Now, I think I might just blank that out if you don't mind. Just take that off. I really want to focus on the chapter itself now. So if you would just like to open your Bible, good thing to do at a Bible class, isn't it, actually? And let's just open to chapter 4, take a look at what we have here before us. Keep your marker there in chapter 4. I will be going to some other references, but focusing always on chapter 4. And in James chapter 5, it says this. Take my brethren, the prophets, who have spoken in the name of the Lord for an example of suffering affliction and of patience. And I think this is a good background verse. Whenever we're in the Old Testament, or whenever we're looking at a prophecy, and we're looking at the man who gave the message, and James is saying, take these as an example. Look at these men and what they went through, and take them to heart. And so just let's remember this as we look through the message and think. And sometimes I think we might just, when we're reading through these messages, we might think, this is pretty complex, you know what I mean? What's this all got to do with me? And Brother Peter, I don't know if you noticed in his prayer as he began this evening, he said that despite the fact that this message was written up thousands of years ago, in fact 2,750 odd years ago, it's a relevant message for today. Now, if it weren't a relevant message, why would we even bother to open it? It'd be pointless. There would be absolutely no point to any of this, and we'd be wasting our time studying it if it were just a history lesson. And so, because that is the reason that it's here, then obviously what it means to each one of us is we've got to look and find the personal message. And if we're not finding the personal message, we're not looking hard enough. It's that simple, isn't it? I got to say that I don't think it comes easy in these chapters to see the personal messages that God has for us. So that's the task of any brother who stands up here to give a Bible study, particularly on these Old Testament passages, is to bring out the personal lessons and make them relevant. Now, going back to our passage in James, just to sort of really force the point a little bit, we know very well what kind of a man Amos was. Thankfully, we get a bit of an insight through his own words. We don't often get that in a prophet. But we find out a little bit about his background. I'm going to have to lubricate my throat a little bit. I try not to do that because the water here doesn't taste very good. I don't know why it is, but this hall does not have good tasting water. I think we're on the end of the line. But anyway, the point in looking at the prophet is that indeed we can take out from what he says and what he does a personal lesson. Now, what James is telling us here is of suffering affliction and of patience. And I have mentioned some of this before. I really don't mind repeating it if I have, and I hope you won't mind. But think of how his message would have been received. We know by what he says that it would not have been well received, and especially when we start in verse 1 of chapter 4 tonight, you fat cows of Bashan. I mean, what kind of language is that? It's pretty strong. And we can imagine the response that he would have got by giving this kind of a message. He would have suffered affliction. he would have suffered ridicule. And especially to the leaders of the people, what he said would have been particularly unwelcome. And not only would he have been ridiculed verbally, I have absolutely no doubt that he would have been made very unwelcome wherever he went, and more than likely suffered some physical persecution as well. Now, along with the suffering, James says, look at the lesson of patience. Now, consider what Amos is revealing to the people. He's revealing what God has told him. God has given it to him somehow in his own mind, by a vision, by a dream, however he received this vision. And here, Amos is looking ahead and he's seeing the onslaught of the Assyrians. And we know in looking at the history books of how the Assyrians did business in war, and it was horrific. And you can imagine the prophet seeing this in the vision and knowing what was coming upon the people. The patience. On the one hand, he's seeing the neglect of his own people, the failure to respond. How is he possibly going to put up with this on the one hand? He can't get that message across. And we get frustrated. And we often talk about it. We talk about it, about how we give a message to our friends, our interested friends. And sometimes we almost bang it on the head with a hammer. And we say they just don't get it. What's with these people? They don't get it. And if we have that, we get vexed with it. You can imagine poor old Amos. He's telling them about the threat to their existence. He's telling them about the onslaught that's just there waiting to happen. And they couldn't care less. They just couldn't have cared less. Because they were so involved in the things that they were doing, they had no time for Amos. How many times do you think Amos was invited over to give a Bible class? I would imagine it was a big fat zero. Because Amos, he would have received the same ridicule that Jesus received. You don't want to listen to him. Why? He comes from Nazareth. They said of Jesus, he'd be born of fornication. They found everything they could not to hear his message. They discounted the man. They ridiculed the man. And so this all adds up to the patience and the suffering that Amos went through as a prophet. It would not have been an easy job. If we just imagine that a prophet sort of stood in the town square, unrolled the scroll and started to read off a message and then get down and go home, we've got the wrong idea of what a prophet was really about and what he did. Now, we know that God chose his men because of their passion for the things of God. And we mentioned, I think it was last time, the fact that we mentioned the reluctant prophet Jonah. Now, we all know that Jonah didn't want to go to Nineveh. And so I think sometimes we get a real big negative on Jonah. Now, I understand that Jonah didn't want to go to Nineveh. I wouldn't have wanted to go to Nineveh either. He was going right into the capital city of the Assyrians, the enemy of Israel. Who would want to do that job? But we see the caliber of the individual and why God forced him to go into Nineveh, in that Jonah converted the whole city. Can you imagine if we did that? How exciting that would be. If we gained a dozen people out of a campaign effort, we would be so ecstatic. And here was Jonah. All the people in the city repented. Now, we know it didn't last. But it was an amazing reaction to an amazing man with an amazing message. And God knew what Jonah was like. He knew that he could speak a good message. He knew that he could convince the people. So that's why he wouldn't let him go out to wherever he wanted to go. He wasn't going to let it happen. And so God selected his men. And here he is with Amos, an amazing individual. It would have been a wonderful thing to have spent the day with Amos with the cattle. Can you just imagine out there and at the end of the day and you could just sit down with Amos? Or maybe just be with him while he's working on the fig trees. You know, you tag along and try and help out. What you would hear from that man Amos. He wouldn't be just talking about the weather. Amos would have been talking about the events that were happening, the current events, and the things that were about to happen. Absolutely guaranteed that's what he was about. All right, verse 1, chapter 4. Hear this word, you cows, as it was in the New English Version, which Maddie read for us. You kine, I'm reading AV, you kine of Bashan, that are in the mountain of Samaria, which oppress the poor, which crush your needy, which say unto their lords, Revised Version, Masters, Authorized Version, husbands, New King James. Bring and let us drink. Now, I want you to pause for just a minute and just take a look at that verse and see what's wrong. What's wrong here? Why is the prophet so upset? What's the deal? Remember, we're looking at these words to try and extract a message for now. Bashan was an area east of the Sea of Galilee. It was apparently, I haven't been there, so I don't know, but I'm just reading the books. It tells me it's a wide, beautiful, lush plain, absolutely ideal for raising cattle. And so the cows there were fat and they were sleek, big animals. The contemporary English version, the CEV, renders it, you women of Samaria are fat cows. Whoa, that's pretty strong language. But there's something that is seriously wrong. What is wrong is that the women are completely out of their place. Now, if the versions that tell us that this applies to the women, and I don't know if we can be 100% absolutely certain of this, it may be a message for the men, but it seems to be that it's focused on the women. But do you notice something about the women here? The women are oppressing the poor. They're crushing the needy. And they're saying to their husbands, bring and let us drink. Now, I know that all of you, and all of you sisters are saying, this is absolutely wrong. This isn't how it should be. The women are completely out of their place. Now, as a speaking brother, I know we run risks. And when we talk about the role of sisters, it's a dangerous place to go for a speaking brother because, number one, it's very easy to be misunderstood. And in some areas, it's a controversial subject. And so it's quite often a subject that doesn't win you points. And if you're a speaker that wants to stay in favour with everyone, you wouldn't even dare to go there. And I might be a little bit reluctant myself, but I'm going to trust you all tonight because I feel very comfortable here. with you folks. And I feel that most of you here, if not all of you, you'll understand where I'm coming from. If I just sneak off a little bit off the subject, not too much, and talk about the role of women. Because it falls right here in the time of Amos. And we see the huge extreme that's happened in Israel with these women in the capital city of Israel, in the city of Samaria, and they've gone to such an extreme that they're doing totally the opposite of what they're supposed to be doing. Now, alongside of the women, we might ask the question, where are the men? Well, the men have failed in their duty. It's obvious. The men are not men, and the women are not women. So if you would allow me just a little bit, please, and be patient with me on this. I know it's easy to be misunderstood, but if I can just go to the New Testament, if you want to come with me, that's good. Let's just leave a finger in Amos. But and Brother Stephen did a beautiful job in this whole subject, a couple of years ago, Stephen, I think it was, and took us through this whole thing of the role of sisters, and I think did a very exhaustive, and I don't mean exhausting, I mean exhaustive. He did a thorough job on that study. But I'm just going to just go to a couple things here, just to tie in with what we're trying to say. 1 Timothy 2:12. But I permit not a woman to teach, nor to have dominion over a man, but to be in quietness. For Adam was first formed, then Eve. And you've got to say to the Apostle Paul, when he says here in verse 13, tell us something we don't know, Paul. He's saying, Adam was first formed, then Eve. Well, we all know that. We've read the book. But what Paul is actually saying here is, don't you understand that there was a specific role for the woman in creation? Because he created man, but then he added the woman. He added the woman to complete the picture. In other words, the creation wasn't complete until the woman was there alongside the man. And then he mentions the transgression, that the woman was deceived and she was in the transgression. And we say, oh, that means a woman's inferior. Well, no, it doesn't at all, because Adam also did this very same thing. But what Paul is really striving after, I think, is in verse 15, nevertheless, she shall be saved in childbearing through the raising up of children, if they continue in faith and love and sanctification with sobriety. Now, these are the qualities of a mum. You can't save anybody as a mum if you don't continue in faith and love and sanctification and sobriety. See how Paul just brings it through to the fore, how God created man and then he created woman, and here's the role of woman, that she's going to raise children, and if she does it with faith, love, sanctification and sobriety, she will be redeemed. And she will be the redeemer. I don't think there's anything too difficult to understand here. That is the specific role of a woman. And there's no mention of a man. That's interesting. If we go over to 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 9 and 10, we have this. Let not a widow be taken into the number under 80 years old, having been the wife of one man well reported of for good works. And here we see the qualities of a sister in Christ. Well reported of for good works. If she have brought up children, if she have lodged strangers, if she have washed the saints' feet, if she have relieved the afflicted, if she have diligently followed every good work. Now tell me, sisters, do you lack a job? Is there anything that, you know, that you might find to do in the ecclesia? You see, this is the role that Paul is outlining of a sister. A tremendous role. And we are so misunderstood quite often because it's assumed that we say because a woman does not do the same as a man, that she's inferior. And nothing could be further from the truth. We're equal. There's neither male nor female. You're all one in Christ Jesus. That's the status. What don't we understand that God has given us different roles? The man does one thing, the woman does another. Now, I didn't mention here in Timothy all the things that apply to a man. Chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4, verse after verse after verse about what a man should be. Way more than what a woman, than the instruction for a woman. But when it comes to the woman, we're given very clear and precise details. And if we don't get the picture, then we can read a little further. And I'm just touching the very surface here. But we know that we have a difficulty within the brotherhood on this. And we've had to address it here on the island. And in fact, we've seen that it's such a threat to our existence that all of the arranging brethren have decided to come together in order to work together on this particular problem. I've just been to Australia. It's a huge problem in Australia. It's not understood. And the way it's presented is, well, it's time that people and brothers recognize that sisters have a brain. Well, was there ever any doubt that sisters had brains? Women are completely capable of all kinds of flying a space shuttle. Whatever it takes, a woman can do it. There's no question about a woman's intelligence. The question becomes, what is the woman's role? What is the man's role? Men cannot do what a woman can do. It's as plain and simple as that. We have not been given the makeup. And the woman has been given specific roles that she can work within the areas that God has created her for. Simple as that. While I was at the conference in Adelaide, there was a very large gathering of the sisters, at the sisters' tea, I think they call it. And as we all do after such an event, all the brothers want to know what happened at the sisters' tea. And it came to me that a sister did a very valuable study. Sister Sue Knight, as a matter of fact. We have three copies of her book on there. On our library, published by the Christadelphian office. And what I saw of this sister, she's a very talented sister indeed. And apparently, what Sister Sue said to all of the sisters assembled in that class, she said, there is absolutely no need for any sister to aspire to the platform. We have more than enough to do. That's, in my words, that's how I understood what was said to those assembled. And I think that's absolutely a beautiful summary And it puts in context the struggle that's going on in Adelaide and in other areas as well, where there is a deliberate agenda to get sisters up on the platform and speaking. It's a misguided direction. We could spend quite a bit of time on it, but we've already done so through Brother Stephen and other classes as well. We don't need to do that here. But what I'll just bring that up because it comes out in Amos. And here we are, we have the leaders in Israel. They're now women. And the men have abdicated their leadership. And the women are saying to the men, "Will you bring us the drink?" And the women are the ones who are the ones who are oppressing the poor. Totally the opposite of the characteristics of a sister in Paul to Timothy. So you see what's wrong here in Israel? Now, we say that as we look in at this picture, this is exactly what we've got today. I'm not just talking about the ecclesia world, I'm talking about the world at large. It is the problem. The men are not exercising the leadership in many ways. And so here in Israel, where God had established the order of men, or should I say, we know that Israel had long been corrupted through idolatry and so on, but his people should have had a right structure with the priests. And we notice that God never ordained female priests. God always ordained the sons of Aaron to be the priests of Israel, to be the spiritual leaders and to take that responsibility seriously. But here the women are sitting in positions of authority, and now they're doing what they're doing here in verse 1. And again, we can see that the men have failed in their duty. All right, so what's going to happen as a result? The Lord God hath sworn by his holiness that, lo, the day shall come upon you that he will take you away with hooks, and your residue or your posterity with fish hooks. And that's what happens. When we mess with God's divine authority and the positions that he establishes, this is what follows. And we can surely say, brothers and sisters, within the ecclesia, that you should know them by their fruits. Somebody's got some new idea or some way of doing it. I say, okay, let's just see what happens. And we see by the fruit that's produced whether this thing is in actual fact good or bad. And this is what's happening in Israel. They will be taken away with hooks. You know who this is referring to? It's the Assyrian. The Assyrians are famous in history for taking their captives out of the cities which they capture by putting a hook, piercing a hook, and putting it through their body parts, and quite often through their mouth or through their lips, and dragging them one after another, one attached to the other, to totally humiliate these people, and they drag them off into captivity with hooks, literally through their bodies. And here's Amos giving this very strong message to the people. The days will come upon you. And they would be taken with hooks and with fish hooks. In verse 3, to continue on this, he says, you shall go out at the breaches. So you see the picture forming of the captivity that's going to take place when the Assyrian comes into Samaria, smashes down the walls of the city, and they make breaches in that wall, and out through those breaches go the people who are not already destroyed in the captivity. They're taken out captive by the hooks, put through their mouths or where, their noses or wherever, and dragged out into captivity. They will go out of the breaches, every one at every one straight before her. And that's how they did it. They did it in a straight line. I just read the Revised Version. And they did it in a straight line. You can imagine the picture that was being formed here as these people are led out of one city, and as they're being led into the victor city, the long, long line of captives being dragged along. It would have been an impressive but sad, miserable picture. "Ye shall cast them into the palace, saith the Lord." And that last part of chapter verse 3 is apparently very difficult in the translation, and some have suggested the Revised Version margin, for example, says that the text is probably corrupt. So it's very difficult to try and comment on that part of the verse. It's not clear. It's a little obscure. So I don't plan to try and even attempt to. In verse 4, we come to Beth-El. And we know that Beth-El, Beth means house, El means God, and here is the house of God. It's not referring to the house of God. The city name means house of God. Sorry if I confused you there. Come to Beth-El and transgress. And this is exactly what Jeroboam the first did. If you just keep your finger here, go back just to remind you of the time of Jeroboam, in the time of Rehoboam in Judah, in Jerusalem. Here was Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, 1 Kings chapter 12. And verse 25 through 33. "Then Jeroboam built Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim, and dwelt therein, and went out from thence, and built Penuel. And Jeroboam said in his heart, Now shall the kingdom return to the house of David. If this people go up to offer sacrifice in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then shall the heart of this people turn again unto their Lord, even unto Rehoboam, king of Judah." Obviously not what he wanted. "And they shall kill me and return to Rehoboam, king of Judah. Whereupon the king took counsel and made two calves of gold, and he said unto them, It is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. And he set the one in Beth-El, and the other put he in Dan, and this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one, even unto Dan. And he made houses of high places, and made priests from among all the people, which were not of the sons of Levi. And Jeroboam ordained a feast in the 8th month, on the 15th day of the month, like unto the feast that is in Judah, and he went up unto the altar. So did he in Beth-El, sacrificing unto the calves that he had made, and he placed in Beth-El the priests of the high places which he had made. And he went up unto the altar which he had made in Beth-El on the 15th day in the 8th month, even in the month which he had devised of his own heart. And he ordained a feast for the children of Israel, and went up unto the altar to burn incense." So you see what Jeroboam did. What he did was duplicate the true worship. Now, he didn't completely duplicate it, because he chose priests who weren't of Levi. He directly went against God's command in that, obviously. He set up calves. Obviously, that's idolatry. But he did something, and he duplicated the feast times. He obviously made these times a time of great rejoicing. He made these happy times for people so that he could keep them away from Judah. He didn't want them going back to Jerusalem. He wanted to keep them up in Samaria and from Beth-El north. So the best thing you can do, if you're going to influence a people or influence anybody, is not to make a radical change. If you want to do something, you just sort of slip it in and make it sound right and feel right, and the people just swallow it up. And this is what obviously has happened in the church over the years. You look at the history of the Catholic Church, and you'll see how they introduced. I mean, we look at the Catholic Church today and we say, "Whoa, these things are terrible. Look at what they do. Well, you look back and you see down through the history the list of things that were introduced one after another down through time. It took a long time to get to where they are today. It's interesting, I don't know if you might know this or not, but the Catholic Church in Latin America, particularly in South America, where they're established in areas where there's quite a bit of voodoo and black magic and these kind of things, they mix things a little bit with these other religions in order to attract the people so that there's not a radical shift from one thing to the other. And so wherever you go within the Catholic Church within Latin America, and Latin America is huge, you'll find that the Catholic Church isn't the same in every place. There are differences within the church according to the location and according to the practices of those people. And they've adopted a lot of, for example, some of the native practices and part of their celebrations. They've incorporated them in so that these people can come in and see that the church is a comfortable place to be. And so it was with Israel under Jeroboam. He made it so that it was similar enough that the people wouldn't be too uncomfortable, and brought them in. He said, "These are the gods that brought you up out of Egypt." Totally false. But by some rationalization, many people fell for it, and of course they were led away into idolatry. All right, and then where are we? We're in verse 4. And he says, "And bring your sacrifices every morning and your tithes after 3 days." Important to get those tithes in, by the way. And but he mentions Gilgal there. "Come to Bethel and transgress. At Gilgal, multiply transgression." And what was Gilgal all about? If you just go back a few pages to Hosea, there's a couple of interesting verses on Gilgal that you might want to note. Hosea chapter 4 and verse 15. "Though thou, Israel, play the harlot, yet let not Judah offend. And come not ye unto Gilgal, neither go you up to Beth Aven, nor swear as the Lord liveth." Okay, so we've got mention of Gilgal there. It's not entirely clear yet what's going on. But as we go over to chapter 9 of Hosea, we see it's very plain. In verse 15, "All their wickedness is in Gilgal. For there I hated them, for the wickedness of their doings. I will drive them out of mine house. I will love them no more. All their princes are revolters." And here's a man who was contemporary with Amos. So when Amos talks about Gilgal, we can understand from Hosea, this was the situation. There's absolutely no doubt as to what Gilgal was all about. So now back into Amos. "Transgress at Gilgal, multiply transgression." So this was the burden. This was the burden of Amos when he looked at what was going on. He said, this is what's happening. And he's pointing out their sins. Verse 5, "And offer a sacrifice of thanksgiving with leaven, and proclaim and publish the free offerings." And perhaps we won't go to it right now, but the only time that Israel could offer a sacrifice with leaven bread was the thanksgiving offering. And you'll find that in Leviticus chapter 7, verse 12 and 13. Otherwise, as you know, they had to offer unleavened bread. But here was a time that they could offer leavened bread. And if you look at the last part of that verse, it says, "Proclaim and publish the free offerings, for this liketh you, O ye children of Israel." And that's very awkward in the authorized version. The ESV, the English Standard Version, says, "So you love to do." They loved a feast. They had no difficulty with the feasts. They loved to do it. So what was the problem? We're starting to see the burden of Amos in these words. Because the people loved religion. And that is quite often true today. People love religion, or many people love religion. How many people love truth? And this is what the psalmist says. And I think the psalmist here is as the psalmist often is, the psalmist takes us right to the very heart, literally, of the matter. In Psalm 51, this is what he says. And you'll know these words. You don't even need to refer to them if you don't wish to. The psalmist, speaking to God, says, "For thou desirest not sacrifice, else would I give it. Thou delightest not in burnt offering. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and a contrite heart. O God, thou wilt not despise. Do good in thy good pleasure unto Zion. Build thou the walls of Jerusalem. Then shalt thou be pleased with the sacrifices of righteousness, with burnt offering and whole burnt offering. Then shall they offer bullocks upon thine altar." So the animals meant absolutely nothing unless they should be accompanied with this broken and contrite heart. And this was the problem. This was the burden that Amos saw. They wanted the religion. They just didn't want the broken and the contrite heart. They didn't want what God wanted, and God wanted their heart. He wanted their mind. He didn't want what they could offer on an altar. I mean, anyone can do that. What he wanted was the love of his people. He wanted the genuine truth. And if we're looking for a message, a personal message, well, surely that's it for us today. How easy it is for us to get it on the outside, but not get it on the inside. And I imagine if we could say to somebody, "Well, this is really all you have to do in order to receive eternal life. You just have to do these certain things." Maybe we would get people interested in that concept. But when we talk about a commitment, not to just a set of beliefs, but when we talk about a commitment to a way of life, then things begin to change. Now all of a sudden there isn't time. Now all of a sudden the game has changed. Because now what we're asking, or what we're not asking, God is asking it through his word. We're just passing the message on if we're faithful preachers of the word. What God is saying is, "I really want you, all of you, everything about you. It's mine." And we might say, "Well, Lord, do you want my house?" God says, "Yes, I want your house." "But God, do you want my car?" "Yeah, I want your car." "Do you want everything I own?" "Well, yes, I do. I want everything you own." "But what about my bank account?" "Yeah, I want that too." "But Lord, that means I've got nothing." And God could say, yes, it's all yours. I'm lending it to you. Use it wisely. You see, the person that can't make that commitment and hand everything over to God, and who just wants to accumulate things for self, can never understand the word of God. And this was the problem in Israel. They wanted to accumulate wealth. They didn't want to hand it over to God. Now, we are all wealthy, but if we hand it to God, then he can give it back to us and we can use it in his service. That's the way it should be. Everything we have is on loan. We don't own one single thing in this life. Everything is God's. The cattle upon 1,000 hills, they're all his. What belongs to us? Nothing. Even the breath, we have to give it back. What don't we understand? And this was the great misunderstanding in Israel. They plain and simply did not get it. And so that's why things went haywire. That's why the women were doing things that women were not designed to do. They weren't nurturing those babies and raising them up for the Lord. They're more interested in what they could get out of life for themselves, bring on the drink. They weren't interested in nurturing a family in the things of God. And that's where women excel. That's where God intended in the very beginning. In the nurturing of children. Timothy. Wonderful, isn't it, when we understand it? Men, get out there and do what you're supposed to do. Lead the people. Where are the leaders in Israel? Sleeping. Watching the ball game. Doing what men do. Lazy men. And brothers, if we are lazy, we are absolutely in the wrong. Men must be active. Men must be workers. Men must be diligent. Men must be leaders. And women must be those who support, nourish, and build the family of God. Could it be clearer? That's Amos. Don't you love a prophet? Don't you love a prophet who speaks the word of God and says it just exactly how it is? So, good old Amos, he's not as plain as we thought he was. He's got a good message for every one of us. The only thing I could say now, brothers and sisters, as we must finish our class, and we haven't finished chapter 4 yet, maybe next time, God willing. The only thing I think we could say in conclusion to our message tonight is, let's just take it to heart.